You may be wondering what all this has to do with introversion and extroversion. Don't we all get a little carried away sometimes? The answer is yes, except that some of us do so more than others. Dorn has observed that her extroverted clients are more likely to be highly reward sensitive, while the introverts are more likely to pay attention to warning signals. They're more successful at regulating their feelings of desire or excitement. They protect themselves better from the downside. My introvert traders are much more able to say, "Okay, Janice, I do feel these excited emotions coming up in me, but I understand that I can't act on them." The introverts are much better at making a plan, staying with a plan, being very disciplined. To understand why introverts and extroverts might react differently to the prospect of rewards, says Dorn, you have to know a little about brain structure. As we saw in Chapter 4, our limbic system, which we share with the most primitive mammals, and which Dorn calls the old brain, is emotional and instinctive. It comprises various structures, including the amygdala, and it's highly interconnected with the nucleus accumbens, sometimes called the brain's pleasure center. We examined the anxious side of the old brain when we explored the role of the amygdala in high reactivity and introversion. Now, we're about to see its greedy side. The old brain, according to Dorn, is constantly telling us, "Yes, yes, yes, eat more, drink more, have more sex, take lots of risk, go for all the gusto you can get, and above all, do not think." The reward-seeking, pleasure-loving part of the old brain is what Dorn believes spurred Alan to treat his life savings like chips at the casino. We also have a new brain, called the neocortex, which evolved many thousands of years after the limbic system. The new brain is responsible for thinking, planning, language, and decision-making, some of the very faculties that make us human. Although the new brain also plays a significant role in our emotional lives, it's the seat of rationality. Its job, according to Dorn, includes saying, "No, no, no, don't do that, because it's dangerous, makes no sense, and is not in your best interests, or those of your family, or of society." So where was Alan's neocortex when he was chasing stock market gains? The old brain and the new brain do work together, but not always efficiently. Sometimes they're actually in conflict, and then our decisions are a function of which one is sending out stronger signals. So when Alan's old brain sent its breathless messages up to his new brain, it probably responded as a neocortex should. It told his old brain to slow down. It said, "Watch out." But it lost the ensuing tug of war. We all have old brains, of course. But just as the amygdala of a high reactive person is more sensitive than average to novelty, so do extroverts seem to be more susceptible than introverts to the reward-seeking cravings of the old brain. In fact, some scientists are starting to explore the idea that reward sensitivity is not only an interesting feature of extroversion, it's what makes an extrovert an extrovert. Extroverts, in other words, are characterized by their tendency to seek rewards, from top dog status to sexual highs to cold cash. They've been found to have greater economic, political, and hedonistic ambitions than introverts. Even their sociability is a function of reward sensitivity, according to this view. Extroverts socialize because human connection is inherently gratifying. What underlies all this reward-seeking? The key seems to be positive emotion. Extroverts tend to experience more pleasure and excitement than introverts do. Emotions that are activated, explains the psychologist Daniel Nettle in his illuminating book on personality, in response to the pursuit or capture of some resource that is valued. Excitement builds toward the anticipated capture of that resource. Joy follows its capture. Extroverts, in other words, often find themselves in an emotional state we might call buzz, a rush of energized, enthusiastic feelings. This is a sensation we all know and like, but not necessarily to the same degree or with the same frequency. Extroverts seem to get an extra buzz from the pursuit and attainment of their goals. The basis of buzz appears to be a high degree of activity in a network of structures in the brain, often called the reward system, including the orbitofrontal cortex, the nucleus accumbens, and the amygdala. The job of the reward system is to get us excited about potential goodies. fMRI experiments have shown that the system is activated by any number of possible delights, from anticipation of a squirt of Kool-Aid on the tongue, to money, to pictures of attractive people. The neurons that transmit information in the reward network operate in part through a neurotransmitter, a chemical that carries information between brain cells, called dopamine. Dopamine is the reward chemical released in response to anticipated pleasures. The more responsive your brain is to dopamine, or the higher the level of dopamine you have available to release, some scientists believe, the more likely you are to go after rewards like sex, chocolate, money, and status. Stimulating midbrain dopamine activity in mice gets them to run around excitedly in an empty cage until they drop dead of starvation. Cocaine and heroin, which stimulate dopamine-releasing neurons in humans, make people euphoric. Extroverts' dopamine pathways appear to be more active than those of introverts. Although the exact relationship between extroversion, dopamine, and the brain's reward system has not been conclusively established, early findings have been intriguing. In one experiment, Richard Depew, a neurobiologist at Cornell University, gave an amphetamine that activates the dopamine system to a group of introverts and extroverts, and found that the extroverts had a stronger response. Another study found that extroverts who win gambling games have more activity in the reward-sensitive regions of their brains than victorious introverts do. Still other research has shown that the medial orbitofrontal cortex, a key component of the brain's dopamine-driven reward system, is larger in extroverts than in introverts. By contrast, introverts have a smaller response in the reward system, writes psychologist Nettle, and so go less out of their way to follow up reward cues. They will, like anyone, be drawn from time to time to sex and parties and status. But the kick they get will be relatively small, so they are not going to break a leg to get there. In short, introverts just don't buzz as easily. In some ways, extroverts are lucky. Buzz has a delightful champagne bubble quality. It fires us up to work and play hard. It gives us the courage to take chances. Buzz also gets us to do things that would otherwise seem too difficult, like giving speeches. Imagine you work hard to prepare a talk on a subject you care about. You get your message across, and when you finish, the audience rises to its feet, its clapping sustained and sincere. One person might leave the room feeling, "I'm glad I got my message across, but I'm also happy it's over. Now I can get back to the rest of my life." Another person, more sensitive to buzz, might walk away feeling, "What a trip! Did you hear that applause? Did you see the expression on their faces when I made that life-changing point? This is great!" But buzz also has considerable downsides. Everyone assumes that it's good to accentuate positive emotions, but that isn't correct, the psychology professor Richard Howard told me, pointing to the example of soccer victories that end in violence and property damage. A lot of antisocial and self-defeating behavior results from people who amplify positive emotions. Another disadvantage of buzz may be its connection to risk, sometimes outsized risk. Buzz can cause us to ignore warning signs we should be heeding. When Ted Turner, who appears to be an extreme extrovert, compared the AOL Time Warner deal to his first sexual experience, he may have been telling us that he was in the same buzzy state of mind as an adolescent who's so excited about spending the night with his new girlfriend that he's not thinking much about the consequences. This blindness to danger may explain why extroverts are more likely than introverts to be killed while driving, be hospitalized as a result of accident or injury, smoke, have risky sex, participate in high-risk sports, have affairs, and remarry. It also helps explain why extroverts are more prone than introverts to overconfidence, defined as greater confidence unmatched by greater ability. Buzz is JFK's Camelot, but it's also the Kennedy curse. This theory of extroversion is still young, and it is not absolute. We can't say that all extroverts constantly crave rewards, or that all introverts always break for trouble. Still, the theory suggests that we should rethink the roles that introverts and extroverts play in their own lives and in organizations. It suggests that when it comes time to make group decisions, extroverts would do well to listen to introverts, especially when they see problems ahead. In the wake of the 2008 crash, a financial catastrophe caused in part by uncalculated risk-taking and blindness to threat, it became fashionable to speculate whether we'd have been better off with more women and fewer men, or less testosterone on Wall Street. But maybe we should also ask what might have happened with a few more introverts at the helm, and a lot less dopamine. Several studies answer this question implicitly. Kellogg School of Management professor Camelia Kunin has found that the variation of a dopamine-regulating gene, DRD4, associated with a particularly thrill-seeking version of extroversion, is a strong predictor of financial risk-taking. By contrast, people with a variant of a serotonin-regulating gene linked to introversion and sensitivity take 28% less financial risk than others. They have also been found to outperform their peers when playing gambling games calling for sophisticated decision-making. When faced with a low probability of winning, people with this gene variant tend to be risk-averse. When they have a high probability of winning, they become relatively risk-seeking. Another study of 64 traders at an investment bank found that the highest-performing traders tended to be emotionally stable introverts. Introverts also seem to be better than extroverts at delaying gratification, a crucial life skill associated with everything from higher SAT scores and income to lower body mass index. In one study, scientists gave participants the choice of a small reward immediately, a gift certificate from Amazon, or a bigger gift certificate in 2 to 4 weeks. Objectively, the bigger reward in the near but not immediate future was the more desirable option. But many people went for the "I want it now" choice, and when they did, a brain scanner revealed that their reward network was activated. Those who held out for the larger reward 2 weeks hence showed more activity in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the new brain that talks us out of sending ill-considered emails and eating too much chocolate cake. A similar study suggests that the former group tended to be extroverts and the latter group introverts. Back in the 1990s, when I was a junior associate at a Wall Street law firm, I found myself on a team of lawyers representing a bank considering buying a portfolio of subprime mortgage loans made by other lenders. My job was to perform due diligence, to review the documentation to see whether the loans had been made with the proper paperwork. Had the borrowers been notified of the interest rates they were slated to pay? That the rates would go up over time? The papers turned out to be chock full of irregularities. If I'd been in the banker's shoes, this would have made me nervous, very nervous. But when our legal team summarized the risks in a caution-filled conference call, the bankers seemed utterly untroubled. They saw the potential profits of buying those loans at a discount, and they wanted to go ahead with the deal. Yet it was just this kind of risk-reward miscalculation that contributed to the failure of many banks during the Great Recession of 2008. At about the same time I evaluated that portfolio of loans, I heard a story circulating on Wall Street about a competition among investment banks for a prestigious piece of business. Each of the major banks sent a squad of their top employees to pitch the client. Each team deployed the usual tools, spreadsheets, pitch books, and PowerPoint presentations. But the winning team added its own piece of theatrics. They ran into the room wearing matching baseball caps and T-shirts emblazoned with the letters FUD, an acronym for Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt. In this case, FUD had been crossed out with an emphatic red X. FUD was an unholy trinity. That team, the vanquishers of FUD, won the contest. Disdain for FUD and for the type of person who tends to experience it is what helped cause the crash, says Boykin Curry, a managing director of the investment firm Eagle Capital, who had front row seats to the 2008 meltdown. too much power was concentrated in the hands of aggressive risk-takers. For 20 years, the DNA of nearly every financial institution morphed dangerously, he told Newsweek magazine at the height of the crash. Each time someone at the table pressed for more leverage and more risk, the next few years proved them right. These people were emboldened, they were promoted, and they gained control of ever more capital. Meanwhile, anyone in power who hesitated, who argued for caution, was proved wrong. The cautious types were increasingly intimidated, passed over for promotion. They lost their hold on capital. This happened every day in almost every financial institution, over and over, until we ended up with a very specific kind of person running things. Curry is a Harvard Business School grad, and with his wife, Celery Kemble, a Palm Beach-born designer, a prominent fixture on New York political and social scenes, which is to say that he would seem to be a card-carrying member of what he calls the go-go aggressive crowd, and an unlikely advocate for the importance of introverts. But one thing he's not shy about is his thesis that it was forceful extroverts who caused the global financial crash. People with certain personality types got control of capital and institutions and power, Curry told me, and people who are congenitally more cautious and introverted and statistical in their thinking became discredited and pushed aside. Vincent Kaminsky, a Rice University Business School professor who once served as managing director of research for Enron, the company that famously filed for bankruptcy in 2001 as a result of reckless business practices, told the Washington Post a similar story of a business culture in which aggressive risk-takers enjoyed too high a status relative to cautious introverts. Kaminsky, a soft-spoken and careful man, was one of the few heroes of the Enron scandal. He repeatedly tried to sound the alarm with senior management that the company had entered into business deals risky enough to threaten its survival. When the top brass wouldn't listen, he refused to sign off on these dangerous transactions and ordered his team not to work on them. The company stripped him of his power to review company-wide deals. There have been some complaints, Vince, that you're not helping people to do transactions, the president of Enron told him, according to Conspiracy of Fools, a book about the Enron scandal. Instead, you're spending all your time acting like cops. We don't need cops, Vince. But they did need them, and still do. When the credit crisis threatened the viability of some of Wall Street's biggest banks in 2007, Kaminsky saw the same thing happening all over again. Let's just say that all the demons of Enron have not been exorcised, he told the Post in November of that year. The problem, he explained, was not only that many had failed to understand the risks the banks were taking. It was also that those who did understand were consistently ignored, in part because they had the wrong personality style. Many times I have been sitting across the table from an energy trader, and I would say, your portfolio will implode if this specific situation happens. And the trader would start yelling at me and telling me I'm an idiot, that such a situation would never happen. The problem is that on one side, you have a rainmaker who is making lots of money for the company and is treated like a superstar. And on the other side, you have an introverted nerd. So who do you think wins? But what exactly is the mechanism by which the buzz clouds good judgment? How did Janice Dorn's client, Alan, dismiss the danger sign screaming that he might lose 70% of his life savings? What prompts some people to act as if FUD doesn't exist? One answer comes from an intriguing line of research conducted by the University of Wisconsin psychologist Joseph Newman. Imagine that you've been invited to Newman's lab to participate in one of his studies. You're there to play a game. The more points you get, the more money you win. 12 different numbers flash across a computer screen, one at a time, in no particular order. You're given a button, as if you were a game show contestant, which you can press or not as each number appears. If you press the button for a good number, you win points. If you press for a bad number, you lose points. And if you don't press at all, nothing happens. Through trial and error, you learn that 4 is a nice number, and 9 is not. So the next time the number 9 flashes across your screen, you know not to press that button. Except that sometimes people press the button for the bad numbers, even when they should know better. Extroverts, especially highly impulsive extroverts, are more likely than introverts to make this mistake. Why? Well, in the words of psychologists John Brebner and Chris Cooper, who have shown that extroverts think less and act faster on such tasks, introverts are geared to inspect, and extroverts geared to respond. But the more interesting aspect of this puzzling behavior is not what the extroverts do before they've hit the wrong button, but what they do after. When introverts hit the number 9 button and find they've lost a point, they slow down before moving on to the next number, as if to reflect on what went wrong. But extroverts not only fail to slow down, they actually speed up. This seems strange. Why would anyone do this? Newman explains that it makes perfect sense. If you focus on achieving your goals, as reward-sensitive extroverts do, you don't want anything to get in your way, neither naysayers nor the number 9. You speed up in an attempt to knock these roadblocks down. Yet this is a crucially important misstep, because the longer you pause to process surprising or negative feedback, the more likely you are to learn from it. If you force extroverts to pause, says Newman, they'll do just as well as introverts at the numbers game. But left to their own devices, they don't stop. And so they don't learn to avoid the trouble staring them in the face. Newman says that this is exactly what might happen to extroverts like Ted Turner when bidding for a company on auction. When a person bids up too high, he told me, that's because they didn't inhibit a response they should have inhibited. They didn't consider information that should have been weighing on their decision. Introverts, in contrast, are constitutionally programmed to downplay reward, to kill their buzz, you might say, and scan for problems. As soon as they get excited, says Newman, they'll put the brakes on and think about peripheral issues that may be more important. Introverts seem to be specifically wired or trained, so when they catch themselves getting excited and focused on a goal, their vigilance increases. Introverts also tend to compare new information with their expectations, he says. They ask themselves, is this what I thought would happen? Is it how it should be? And when the situation falls short of expectations, they form associations between the moment of disappointment, losing points, and whatever was going on in their environment at the time of the disappointment, hitting the number 9. These associations let them make accurate predictions about how to react to warning signals in the future. Introverts' disinclination to charge ahead is not only a hedge against risk, it also pays off on intellectual tasks. Here are some of the things we know about the relative performance of introverts and extroverts at complex problem solving. Extroverts get better grades than introverts during elementary school, but introverts outperform extroverts in high school and college. At the university level, introversion predicts academic performance better than cognitive ability. One study tested 141 college students' knowledge of 20 different subjects, from art to astronomy to statistics, and found that introverts knew more than the extroverts about every single one of them. Introverts received disproportionate numbers of graduate degrees, National Merit Scholarship finalist positions, and Phi Beta Kappa keys. They outperform extroverts on the Watson-Glaser Critical Thinking Appraisal Test, an assessment of critical thinking widely used by businesses for hiring and promotion. They've been shown to excel at something psychologists call insightful problem solving. The question is, why? Introverts are not smarter than extroverts. According to IQ scores, the two types are equally intelligent. And on many kinds of tasks, particularly those performed under time or social pressure or involving multitasking, extroverts do better. Extroverts are better than introverts at handling information overload. Introverts' reflectiveness uses up a lot of cognitive capacity, according to Joseph Newman. On any given task, he says, if we have 100% cognitive capacity, an introvert may have only 75% on task and 25% off task. whereas an extrovert may have 90% on task. This is because most tasks are goal-directed. Extroverts appear to allocate most of their cognitive capacity to the goal at hand, while introverts use up capacity by monitoring how the task is going. But introverts seem to think more carefully than extroverts, as the psychologist Gerald Matthews describes in his work. Extroverts are more likely to take a quick and dirty approach to problem solving, trading accuracy for speed, making increasing numbers of mistakes as they go, and abandoning ship altogether when the problem seems too difficult or frustrating. Introverts think before they act, digest information thoroughly, stay on task longer, give up less easily, and work more accurately. Introverts and extroverts also direct their attention differently. If you leave them to their own devices, the introverts tend to sit around wondering about things, imagining things, recalling events from their past, and making plans for the future. The extroverts are more likely to focus on what's happening around them. It's as if extroverts are seeing what is, while their introverted peers are asking, "What if?" Introverts and extroverts contrasting problem-solving styles have been observed in many different contexts. In one experiment, psychologists gave 50 people a difficult jigsaw puzzle to solve and found that the extroverts were more likely than the introverts to quit midway. In another, Professor Richard Howard gave introverts and extroverts a complicated series of printed mazes and found not only that the introverts tended to solve more mazes correctly, but also that they spent a much greater percentage of their allotted time inspecting the maze before entering it. A similar thing happened when the groups of introverts and extroverts were given the Raven Standard Progressive Matrices, an intelligence test that consists of 5 sets of problems of increasing difficulty. The extroverts tended to do better in the first 2 sets, presumably because of their ability to orient quickly to their goal. But on the 3 more difficult sets, where persistence pays, the introverts significantly outperformed them. By the final, most complicated set, the extroverts were much more likely than the introverts to abandon the task altogether. Introverts sometimes outperform extroverts, even on social tasks that require persistence. Wharton Management Professor Adam Grant, who conducted the leadership studies described in Chapter 2, once studied the personality traits of effective call center employees. Grant predicted that the extroverts would be better telemarketers, but it turned out that there was zero correlation between extroversion levels and cold-calling prowess. "The extroverts would make these wonderful calls," Grant told me, "but then a shiny object of some kind would cross their paths, and they'd lose focus. The introverts, in contrast, would talk very quietly, but boom, 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 they were making those calls. They were focused and determined." The only extroverts to outperform them were those who also happened to be unusually high scorers for a separate personality trait, measuring conscientiousness. Introvert persistence was more than a match for extrovert buzz, in other words, even at a task where social skills might be considered at a premium. Persistence isn't very glamorous. If genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, then as a culture, we tend to lionize the 1%. We love its flash and dazzle. But great power lies in the other 99%. "It's not that I'm so smart," said Einstein, who was a consummate introvert. "It's that I stay with problems longer." None of this is to denigrate those who forge ahead quickly, or to blindly glorify the reflective and careful. The point is that we tend to overvalue buzz and discount the risks of reward sensitivity. We need to find a balance between action and reflection. For example, if you were staffing an investment bank, Management Professor Kunin told me, you'd want to hire not only reward-sensitive types, who are likely to profit from bull markets, but also those who remain emotionally more neutral. You'd want to make sure that important corporate decisions reflect the input of both kinds of people, not just one type. And you'd want to know that individuals on all points of the reward sensitivity spectrum understand their own emotional preferences and can temper them to match market conditions. But it's not just employers who benefit from taking a closer look at their employees. We also need to take a closer look at ourselves. Understanding where we fall on the reward sensitivity spectrum gives us the power to live our lives well. If you're a buzz-prone extrovert, then you're lucky to enjoy lots of invigorating emotions. Make the most of them. Build things. Inspire others. Think big. Start a company. Launch a website. Build an elaborate treehouse for your kids. But also know that you're operating with an Achilles heel that you must learn to protect. Train yourself to spend energy on what's truly meaningful to you, instead of on activities that look like they'll deliver a quick buzz of money or status or excitement. Teach yourself to pause and reflect when warning signs appear that things aren't working out as you'd hoped. Learn from your mistakes. Seek out counterparts, from spouses to friends to business partners, who can help rein you in and compensate for your blind spots. And when it comes time to invest, or to do anything that involves a sage balance of risk and reward, keep yourself in check. One good way to do this is to make sure that you're not surrounding yourself with images of reward at the crucial moment of decision. Kunin and Brian Knutson have found that men who are shown erotic pictures just before they gamble take more risks than those shown neutral images, like desks and chairs. This is because anticipating rewards, any rewards, whether or not related to the subject at hand, excites our dopamine-driven reward networks and makes us act more rashly. This may be the single best argument yet for banning pornography from workplaces. And if you're an introvert who's relatively immune to the excesses of reward sensitivity, at first blush, the research on dopamine and buzz seems to imply that extroverts and extroverts alone are happily motivated to work hard by the excitement they get from pursuing their goals. As an introvert, I was puzzled by this idea when I first came across it. It didn't reflect my own experience. I'm in love with my work and always have been. I wake up in the morning excited to get started. So what drives people like me? One answer is that even if the reward sensitivity theory of extroversion turns out to be correct, we can't say that all extroverts are always more sensitive to rewards and blasé about risk, or that all introverts are constantly unmoved by incentives and vigilant about threats. Since the days of Aristotle, philosophers have observed that these two modes, approaching things that appear to give pleasure and avoiding others that seem to cause pain, lie at the heart of all human activity. As a group, extroverts tend to be reward-seeking, but every human being has her own mix of approach and avoidance tendencies, and sometimes the combination differs depending on the situation. Indeed, many contemporary personality psychologists would say that threat-vigilance is more characteristic of a trait known as neuroticism than of introversion. The body's reward and threat systems also seem to work independently of each other, so that the same person can be generally sensitive or insensitive to both reward and threat. If you want to determine whether you are reward-oriented, threat-oriented, or both, try asking yourself whether the following groups of statements are true of you. If you are reward-oriented, 1. When I get something I want, I feel excited and energized. 2. When I want something, I usually go all out to get it. 3. When I see an opportunity for something I like, I get excited right away. 4. When good things happen to me, it affects me strongly. 5. I have very few fears compared to my friends. If you are threat-oriented, 1. Criticism or scolding hurts me quite a bit. 2. I feel pretty worried or upset when I think or know somebody is angry at me. 3. If I think something unpleasant is going to happen, I usually get pretty worked up. 4. I feel worried when I think I have done poorly at something important. 5. I worry about making mistakes. But I believe that another important explanation for introverts who love their work may come from a very different line of research by the influential psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi on the state of being he calls flow. Flow is an optimal state in which you feel totally engaged in an activity, whether long-distance swimming or songwriting, sumo wrestling, or sex. In a state of flow, you're neither bored nor anxious, and you don't question your own adequacy. Hours pass without your noticing. The key to flow is to pursue an activity for its own sake, not for the rewards it brings. Although flow does not depend on being an introvert or an extrovert, many of the flow experiences that Csikszentmihalyi writes about are solitary pursuits that have nothing to do with reward-seeking, reading, tending an orchard, solo ocean cruising. Flow often occurs, he writes, in conditions in which people become independent of the social environment to the degree that they no longer respond exclusively in terms of its rewards and punishments. To achieve such autonomy, a person has to learn to provide rewards to herself. In a sense, Csikszentmihalyi transcends Aristotle. He is telling us that there are some activities that are not about approach or avoidance, but about something deeper. The fulfillment that comes from absorption in an activity outside yourself. Psychological theories usually assume that we are motivated either by the need to eliminate an unpleasant condition like hunger or fear, Csikszentmihalyi writes, or by the expectation of some future reward such as money, status, or prestige. But in flow, a person could work around the clock for days on end, for no better reason than to keep on working. If you're an introvert, find your flow by using your gifts. You have the power of persistence, the tenacity to solve complex problems, and the clear-sightedness to avoid pitfalls that trip others up. You enjoy relative freedom from the temptations of superficial prizes like money and status. Indeed, your biggest challenge may be to fully harness your strengths. You may be so busy trying to appear like a zestful, reward-sensitive extrovert that you undervalue your own talents or feel underestimated by those around you. But when you're focused on a project that you care about, you probably find that your energy is boundless. So stay true to your own nature. If you like to do things in a slow and steady way, don't let others make you feel as if you have to race. If you enjoy depth, don't force yourself to seek breadth. If you prefer single-tasking to multitasking, stick to your guns. Being relatively unmoved by rewards gives you the incalculable power to go your own way. It's up to you to use that independence to good effect. Of course, that isn't always easy. While writing this chapter, I corresponded with Jack Welch, the former chairman of General Electric. He had just published a Business Week online column called Release Your Inner Extrovert, in which he called for introverts to act more extroverted on the job. I suggested that extroverts sometimes need to act more introverted, too, and shared with him some of the ideas you've just read about, how Wall Street might have benefited from having more introverts at the helm. Welch was intrigued. But, he said, the extroverts would argue that they never heard from the introverts. Welch makes a fair point. Introverts need to trust their gut and share their ideas as powerfully as they can. This does not mean aping extroverts. Ideas can be shared quietly. They can be communicated in writing. They can be packaged into highly produced lectures. They can be advanced by allies. The trick for introverts is to honor their own styles instead of allowing themselves to be swept up by prevailing norms. The story of the lead-up to the Great Recession of 2008 is peppered, alas, with careful types who took inappropriate risks, like the former chief executive of Citigroup, Chuck Prince, a former lawyer who made risky loans into a falling market because, he said, as long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance. People who are initially cautious become more aggressive, observes Boykin Curry of this phenomenon. They say, hey, the more aggressive people are getting promoted, and I'm not, So I'm going to be more aggressive too. But stories of financial crises often contain subplots about people who famously and profitably saw them coming. And such tales tend to feature just the kinds of people who embrace FUD, or who like to close the blinds to their offices, insulate themselves from mass opinion and peer pressure, and focus in solitude. One of the few investors who managed to flourish during the crash of 2008 was Seth Klarman, president of a hedge fund called the Baupost Group. Klarman is known for consistently outperforming the market while steadfastly avoiding risk, and for keeping a significant percentage of his assets in cash. In the 2 years since the crash of 2008, when most investors were fleeing hedge funds in droves, Klarman almost doubled Baupost's assets under management to $22 billion. Klarman achieved this with an investment strategy based explicitly on FUD. At Baupost, we are big fans of fear, and in investing, it is clearly better to be scared than sorry, he once wrote in a letter to investors. Klarman is a world-class worrier, observes the New York Times in a 2007 article called Manager Frets Over the Market, but Still Outdoes It. He owns a racehorse called Read the Footnotes. During the years leading up to the 2008 crash, Klarman was one of the few people to stick to a cautious and seemingly paranoid message, says Boykin Curry. When everyone else was celebrating, he was probably storing cans of tuna in his basement to prepare for the end of civilization. Then, when everyone else panicked, he started buying. It's not just analysis. It's his emotional makeup. The same wiring that helps Seth find opportunities that no one else sees can make him seem aloof or blunt. If you're the kind of person who frets every time the quarter is good, you may have trouble rising to the top of a corporate pyramid. Seth probably wouldn't have made it as a sales manager, but he is one of the great investors of our time. Similarly, in his book on the run-up to the 2008 crash, The Big Short, Michael Lewis introduces three of the few people who were astute enough to forecast the coming disaster. One was a solitary hedge fund manager named Michael Burry, who describes himself as happy in my own head, and who spent the years prior to the crash alone in his office in San Jose, California, combing through financial documents and developing his own contrarian views of market risk. The others were a pair of socially awkward investors named Charlie Ledley and Jamie Mai, whose entire investment strategy was based on FUD. They placed bets that had limited downside, but would pay off handsomely if dramatic but unexpected changes occurred in the market. It was not an investment strategy so much as a life philosophy, a belief that most situations were not as stable as they appeared to be. This suited the two men's personalities, writes Lewis. They never had to be sure of anything. Both were predisposed to feel that people, and by extension markets, were too certain about inherently uncertain things. Even after being proven right with their 2006 and 2007 bets against the subprime mortgage market and earning $100 million in the process, they actually spent time wondering how people who had been so sensationally right, i.e. they themselves, could preserve the capacity for diffidence and doubt and uncertainty that had enabled them to be right. Ledley and Mai understood the value of their constitutional diffidence, but others were so spooked by it that they gave up the chance to invest money with the two, in effect, sacrificing millions of dollars to their prejudice against FUD. What's amazing with Charlie Ledley, says Boykin Curry, who knows him well, is that here you had a brilliant investor who was exceedingly conservative. If you were concerned about risk, there was no one better to go to. But he was terrible at raising capital because he seemed so tentative about everything. Potential clients would walk out of Charlie's office scared to give him money because they thought he lacked conviction. Meanwhile, they poured money into funds run by managers who exuded confidence and certainty. Of course, when the economy turned, The confident group lost half their clients' money, while Charlie and Jamie made a fortune. Anyone who used conventional social cues to evaluate money managers was led to exactly the wrong conclusion. Another example, this one from the 2000 crash of the dot-com bubble, concerns a self-described introvert based in Omaha, Nebraska, where he's well known for shutting himself inside his office for hours at a time. Warren Buffett, the legendary investor and one of the wealthiest men in the world, has used exactly the attributes we've explored in this chapter: intellectual persistence, prudent thinking, and the ability to see and act on warning signs, to make billions of dollars for himself and the shareholders in his company, Berkshire Hathaway. Buffett is known for thinking carefully when those around him lose their heads. "Success in investing doesn't correlate with IQ," he has said. "Once you have ordinary intelligence, what you need is the temperament to control the urges that get other people into trouble in investing." Every summer since 1983, the boutique investment bank Allen & Company has hosted a week-long conference in Sun Valley, Idaho. This isn't just any conference. It's an extravaganza with lavish parties, river rafting trips, ice skating, mountain biking, fly fishing, horseback riding, and a fleet of babysitters to care for guests' children. The hosts service the media industry, and past guest lists have included newspaper moguls, Hollywood celebrities, and Silicon Valley stars, with marquee names such as Tom Hanks, Candace Bergen, Barry Diller, Rupert Murdoch, Steve Jobs, Diane Sawyer, and Tom Brokaw. In July 1999, according to Alice Schroeder's excellent biography of Buffett, The Snowball, he was one of those guests. He had attended year after year with his entire family in tow, arriving by Gulfstream jet and staying with the other VIP attendees in a select group of condos overlooking the golf course. Buffett loved his annual vacation at Sun Valley, regarding it as a great place for his family to gather and for him to catch up with old friends. But this year, the mood was different. It was the height of the technology boom, and there were new faces at the table, the heads of technology companies that had grown rich and powerful almost overnight, and the venture capitalists who had fed them cash. These people were riding high. When the celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz showed up to shoot the media all-star team for Vanity Fair, some of them lobbied to get in the photo. They were the future, they believed. Buffett was decidedly not a part of this group. He was an old-school investor who didn't get caught up in speculative frenzy around companies with unclear earnings prospects. Some dismissed him as a relic of the past, but Buffett was still powerful enough to give the keynote address on the final day of the conference. He thought long and hard about that speech and spent weeks preparing for it. After warming up the crowd with a charmingly self-deprecating story — Buffett used to dread public speaking until he took a Dale Carnegie course — he told the crowd, in painstaking, brilliantly analyzed detail, why the tech-fueled bull market wouldn't last. Buffett had studied the data, noted the danger signals, and then paused and reflected on what they meant. It was the first public forecast he had made in 30 years. The audience wasn't thrilled, according to Schroeder. Buffett was raining on their parade. They gave him a standing ovation, but in private, many dismissed his ideas. "Good old Warren," they said. "Smart man, but this time he missed the boat." Later that evening, the conference wrapped up with a glorious display of fireworks. As always, it had been a blazing success. But the most important aspect of the gathering, Warren Buffett alerting the crowd to the market's warning signs, wouldn't be revealed until the following year, when the dot-com bubble burst, just as he said it would. Buffett takes pride not only in his track record, but also in following his own inner scorecard. He divides the world into people who focus on their own instincts and those who follow the herd. "I feel like I'm on my back," says Buffett about his life as an investor. "And there's the Sistine Chapel, and I'm painting away. I like it when people say, 'Gee, that's a pretty good-looking painting.' But it's my painting, and when somebody says, Why don't you use more red instead of blue? Goodbye. It's my painting, and I don't care what they sell it for. The painting itself will never be finished. That's one of the great things about it. Part 3. Do all cultures have an extrovert ideal? Chapter 8. Soft Power. Asian Americans and the Extrovert Ideal. In a gentle way, you can shake the world. Mahatma Gandhi. It's a sunny spring day in 2006, and Mike Wei, a 17-year-old Chinese-born senior at Lynbrook High School near Cupertino, California, is telling me about his experiences as an Asian American student. Mike is dressed in sporty all-American attire of khakis, windbreaker, and baseball cap, but his sweet, serious face and wispy mustache give him the aura of a budding philosopher, and he speaks so softly that I have to lean forward to hear him. At school, says Mike, I'm a lot more interested in listening to what the teacher says and being the good student rather than the class clown or interacting with other kids in the class. If being outgoing, shouting, or acting out in class is gonna affect the education I receive, it's better if I go for education. Mike relates this view matter-of-factly, but he seems to know how unusual it is by American standards. His attitude comes from his parents, he explains. If I have a choice between doing something for myself, like going out with my friends or staying home and studying, I think of my parents. That gives me the strength to keep studying. My father tells me that his job is computer programming, and my job is to study. Mike's mother taught the same lesson by example. A former math teacher who worked as a maid when the family immigrated to North America, she memorized English vocabulary words while washing dishes. She is very quiet, says Mike, and very resolute. It's really Chinese to pursue your own education like that. My mother has the kind of strength that not everyone can see. By all indications, Mike has made his parents proud. His email username is A Student, and he's just won a coveted spot in Stanford University's freshman class. He's the kind of thoughtful, dedicated student that any community would be proud to call its own. And yet, according to an article called The New White Flight that ran in the Wall Street Journal just 6 months previously, white families are leaving Cupertino in droves precisely because of kids like Mike. They are fleeing the sky-high test scores and awe-inspiring study habits of many Asian American students. The article said that white parents feared that their kids couldn't keep up academically. It quoted a student from a local high school. If you were Asian, you had to confirm you were smart. If you were white, you had to prove it. But the article didn't explore what lay behind this stellar academic performance. I was curious whether the town's scholarly bent reflected a culture insulated from the worst excesses of the extrovert ideal, and if so, what that would feel like. I decided to visit and find out. At first blush, Cupertino seems like the embodiment of the American dream. Many first and second generation Asian immigrants live here and work at the local high-tech office parks. Apple Computer's headquarters at One Infinite Loop is in town. Google's Mountain View headquarters is just down the road. Meticulously maintained cars glide along the boulevards. The few pedestrians are crisply dressed in bright colors and cheerful whites. Unprepossessing ranch houses are pricey, but buyers think the cost is worth it to get their kids into the town's famed public school system, with its ranks of Ivy-bound kids. Of the 615 students in the graduating class of 2010 at Cupertino's Monte Vista High School, 77% of whom are Asian American, according to the school's website, some of which is accessible in Chinese. 53 were National Merit Scholarship semi-finalists. The average combined score of Monte Vista students who took the SAT in 2009 was 1916 out of 2400, 27% higher than the nationwide average. Respected kids at Monte Vista High School are not necessarily athletic or vivacious, according to the students I meet here. Rather, they're studious and sometimes quiet. Being smart is actually admired, even if you're weird, a Korean-American high school sophomore named Chris tells me. Chris describes the experience of his friend, whose family left to spend 2 years in a Tennessee town where few Asian Americans lived. The friend enjoyed it, but suffered culture shock. In Tennessee, there were insanely smart people, but they were always by themselves. Here, the really smart people usually have a lot of friends, because they can help people out with their work. The library is to Cupertino what the mall or soccer field is to other towns, an unofficial center of village life. High school kids cheerfully refer to studying as going nerding. Football and cheerleading aren't particularly respected activities. Our football team sucks, Chris says good-naturedly. Though the team's recent stats are more impressive than Chris suggests, having a lousy football team seems to hold symbolic significance for him. You couldn't really even tell they're football players, he explains. They don't wear their jackets and travel in big groups. When one of my friends graduated, they played a video and my friend was like, I can't believe they're showing football players and cheerleaders in this video. That's not what drives this town. Ted Shinta, a teacher and advisor to the robotics team at Monte Vista High School, tells me something similar. When I was in high school, he says, you were discouraged from voting in student elections unless you were wearing a varsity jacket. At most high schools, you have a popular group that tyrannizes the others. But here, the kids in that group don't hold any power over the other students. The student body is too academically oriented for that. A local college counselor named Purvi Modi agrees. Introversion is not looked down upon, she tells me. It is accepted. In some cases, it is even highly respected and admired. It is cool to be a master chess champion and play in the band. There's an introvert-extrovert spectrum here, as everywhere, but it's as if the population is distributed a few extra degrees toward the introverted end of the scale. One young woman, a Chinese-American about to begin her freshman year at an elite East Coast college, noticed this phenomenon after meeting some of her future classmates online and worries what the post-Cupertino future might hold. I met a couple of people on Facebook, she says, and they're just so different. I'm really quiet. I'm not that much of a partier or socializer. But everyone there seems to be very social and stuff. It's just very different from my friends. I'm not even sure if I'm going to have friends when I get there. One of her Facebook correspondents lives in nearby Palo Alto, and I ask how she'll respond if that person invites her to get together over the summer. I probably wouldn't do it, she says. It would be interesting to meet them and stuff. But my mom doesn't want me going out that much, because I have to study. I'm struck by the young woman's sense of filial obligation, and its connection to prioritizing study over social life. But this is not unusual in Cupertino. Many Asian American kids here tell me that they study all summer at their parents' request, even declining invitations to July birthday parties, so they can get ahead on the following October's calculus curriculum. I think it's our culture, explains Tiffany Liao, a poised, Swarthmore-bound high school senior whose parents are from Taiwan. Study, do well, don't create waves. It's inbred in us to be more quiet. When I was a kid and would go to my parents' friend's house and didn't want to talk, I would bring a book. It was like this shield, and they would be like, she's so studious, and that was praise. It's hard to imagine other American moms and dads outside Cupertino smiling on a child who reads in public while everyone else is gathered around the barbecue. But parents schooled a generation ago in Asian countries were likely taught this quieter style as children. In many East Asian classrooms, the traditional curriculum emphasizes listening, writing, reading, and memorization. Talking is simply not a focus, and is even discouraged. The teaching back home is very different from here, says Hung Wei Qian, a Cupertino mom who came to the United States from Taiwan in 1979 to attend graduate school at UCLA. There, you learn the subject, and they test you. At least when I grew up, they don't go off subject a lot, and they don't allow the students to ramble. If you stand up and talk nonsense, you'll be reprimanded. Hung is one of the most jolly, extroverted people I've ever met, given to large, expansive gestures and frequent belly laughs. Dressed in running shorts, sneakers, and amber jewelry, she greets me with a bear hug and drives us to a bakery for breakfast. We dig into our pastries, chatting companionably. So it's telling that even Hung recalls her culture shock upon entering her first American-style classroom. She considered it rude to participate in class because she didn't want to waste her classmates' time. And sure enough, she says, laughing, I was the quiet person there. At UCLA, the professor would start class saying, let's discuss. I would look at my peers while they were talking nonsense, and the professors were so patient, just listening to everyone. She nods her head comically, mimicking the overly respectful professors. I remember being amazed. It was a linguistics class, and that's not even linguistics the students are talking about. I thought, oh, in the U.S., as soon as you start talking, you're fine. If Hung was bewildered by the American style of class participation, it's likely that her teachers were equally perplexed by her unwillingness to speak. A full 20 years after Hung moved to the United States, the San Jose Mercury News ran an article called East-West Teaching Traditions Collide, exploring professors' dismay at the reluctance of Asian-born students like Hung to participate in California university classrooms. One professor noted a deference barrier created by Asian students' reverence for their teachers. Another vowed to make class participation part of the grade in order to prod Asian students to speak in class. You're supposed to downgrade yourself in Chinese learning because other thinkers are so much greater than you, said a third. This is a perennial problem in classes with predominantly Asian American students. The article generated a passionate reaction in the Asian American community. Some said the universities were right that Asian students need to adapt to Western educational norms. Asian Americans have let people walk all over them because of their silence, posted a reader of the sardonically titled website modelminority.com. Others felt that Asian students shouldn't be forced to speak up and conform to the Western mode. Perhaps instead of trying to change their ways, colleges can learn to listen to their sound of silence, wrote Hee Jung Kim, a Stanford University cultural psychologist, in a paper arguing that talking is not always a positive act. How is it that Asians and Westerners can look at the exact same classroom interactions, and one group will label it class participation, and the other talking nonsense? The Journal of Research in Personality has published an answer to this question in the form of a map of the world, drawn by research psychologist Robert McCrae. McCrae's map looks like something you'd see in a geography textbook, but it's based, he says, not on rainfall or population density, but on personality trait levels, and its shadings of dark and light grays, dark for extroversion, light for introversion, reveal a picture that is quite clear. Asia is introverted, Europe extroverted. Had the map also included the United States, it would be colored dark gray. Americans are some of the most extroverted people on Earth. McCrae's map might seem like a grand exercise in cultural stereotyping. To group entire continents by personality type is an act of gross generalization. You can find loud people in mainland China just as easily as in Atlanta, Georgia. Nor does the map account for subtleties of cultural difference within a country or region. People in Beijing have different styles from those in Shanghai, and both are different still from the citizens of Seoul or Tokyo. Similarly, describing Asians as a model minority, even when meant as a compliment, is just as confining and condescending as any description that reduces individuals to a set of perceived group characteristics. Perhaps it is also problematic to characterize Cupertino as an incubator for scholarly standouts, no matter how flattering this might sound to some. But although I don't want to encourage rigid national or ethnic typecasting, to avoid entirely the topic of cultural difference and introversion would be a shame. There are too many aspects of Asian culture and personality styles that the rest of the world could and should learn from. Scholars have for decades studied cultural differences in personality type, especially between East and West, and especially the dimension of introversion-extroversion. The one pair of traits that psychologists, who agree on practically nothing when it comes to cataloging human personality, believe is salient and measurable all over the world. Much of this research yields the same results as McRae's map. One study comparing 8 to 10-year-old children in Shanghai and southern Ontario, Canada, for example, found that shy and sensitive children are shunned by their peers in Canada, but make sought-after playmates in China, where they are also more likely than other children to be considered for leadership roles. Chinese children who are sensitive and reticent are said to be dong shi, understanding, a common term of praise. Similarly, Chinese high school students tell researchers that they prefer friends who are humble and altruistic, honest and hardworking, while American high school students seek out the cheerful, enthusiastic, and sociable. The contrast is striking, writes Michael Harris Bond, a cross-cultural psychologist who focuses on China. The Americans emphasize sociability and prize those attributes that make for easy, cheerful association. The Chinese emphasize deeper attributes, focusing on moral virtues and achievement. Another study asked Asian Americans and European Americans to think out loud while solving reasoning problems, and found that the Asians did much better when they were allowed to be quiet, compared to the Caucasians, who performed well when vocalizing their problem-solving. These results would not surprise anyone familiar with traditional Asian attitudes to the spoken word. Talk is for communicating need-to-know information. Quiet and introspection are signs of deep thought and higher truth. Words are potentially dangerous weapons that reveal things better left unsaid. They hurt other people. They can get their speaker into trouble. Consider, for example, these proverbs from the East. The wind howls, but the mountain remains still. Japanese proverb. Those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know. Lao Tzu, the way of Lao Tzu. Even though I make no special attempt to observe the discipline of silence, living alone automatically makes me refrain from the sins of speech. Kamo no Chome, 12th century Japanese recluse, and compare them to proverbs from the West. Be a craftsman in speech, that thou mayest be strong, for the strength of one is the tongue, and speech is mightier than all fighting. Maxims of Ptahotep, 3400 BCE. Speech is civilization itself. The word, even the most contradictory word, preserves contact. It is silence which isolates. Thomas Mann, The Magic Mountain. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. What lies behind these starkly different attitudes? One answer is the widespread reverence for education among Asians, particularly those from Confucian Belt countries like China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. To this day, some Chinese villages display statues of students who passed the grueling Ming Dynasty era Qin Shi exam hundreds of years ago. It's a lot easier to achieve that kind of distinction if, like some of the kids from Cupertino, you spend your summers studying. Another explanation is group identity. Many Asian cultures are team-oriented, but not in the way that Westerners think of teams. Individuals in Asia see themselves as part of a greater whole, whether family, corporation, or community, and place tremendous value on harmony within their group. They often subordinate their own desires to the group's interests, accepting their place in its hierarchy. Western culture, by contrast, is organized around the individual. We see ourselves as self-contained units. Our destiny is to express ourselves, to follow our bliss, to be free of undue restraint, to achieve the one thing that we, and we alone, were brought into this world to do. We may be gregarious, but we don't submit to group will, or at least we don't like to think we do. We love and respect our parents, but bridle at notions like filial piety, with their implications of subordination and restraint. When we get together with others, we do so as self-contained units, having fun with, competing with, standing out from, jockeying for position with, and yes, loving other self-contained units. Even the Western God is assertive, vocal, and dominant. His son Jesus is kind and tender, but also a charismatic, crowd-pleasing man of influence, Jesus Christ Superstar.